Hello, everyone. I am Dominique Mariso.
Hi, I'm Michael R. Jackson.
Hi, I'm Jocelyn Beal.
Hey, guys, it's Saheem Ali, and you are listening to the Call and Response podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Call and Response podcast with Felicia Fitzpatrick. And y'all, it's actually a really big week this week because podcast alum Dominique Mariso was nominated for a Tony Award. As y'all know, she made her Broadway debut writing the book for Ain't Too Proud, The Life and the Times of the Temptations this season. And I got to see her at the Tony's press day the other day. I could not be more excited. We hugged, we yelled, we laughed, we praised. It was amazing. So congratulations to Dominique. And for this week, y'all know, if you don't know, now you know that I have had some bomb ass / quirky birthday party themes. One time it was New York themed, of course. Once it was Camp Glam, which was inspired by the cinematic masterpiece True Beverly Hills. Another time it was Sandra Bullock and Reese Witherspoon themed, where I forced my friends to watch their movies during our sleepover. And then in eighth grade, I made my friends again do something crazy, which was participate in a scavenger hunt in the mall the day after Christmas. And I'm sorry, friends, for that. But I love scavenger hunts, which is why I thought it'd be so fun. And it is the latest and greatest event that Gold Star has suggested for me. The amazing Great Coney Island Scavenger Hunt is a mix of hunt and an obstacle course. And if I was in better shape, you know I would be there. But that is just the beginning with Gold Star. They provide theater, comedy shows, concerts, and so much more. So download Gold Star and let's make some memories, y'all. Every week I say I'm hype, I'm thrilled, I'm excited. I will continue to say it every week. Y'all will have to deal because every week I am hype and thrilled and excited to talk to the amazing artists that I get to meet. This week's guest, he's my first director that I'm interviewing, which is one level, but also has an incredible body of work that I'm not going to be able to name all of, so y'all just need to check out his website. But select credits include working with Donye R. Love on the Love Plays trilogy, so Fireflies at Atlantic you probably saw, or Sugar in Our Wounds at MTC, and a workshop of In the Middle at the Lark, or Dangerous House at Williamstown Theater Festival. But y'all, like, that's what he's been working on recently, and he will soon be working on Fires in the Mirror with Anna Deavere Smith at The Signature, Nollywood Dreams with Jocelyn Beal, podcast alum at MCC, and is currently working on Passage by Chris Chen at Soho Rep. It is Saheem Ali.
Hello, hello.
Hi. That was quite the intro, huh?
Hey, it was amazing. Thank you. Thanks, Felicia.
No, but it is, like, it's so impressive because you are just out here making art happen. It's thrilling.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yes, and we're going to dive in today. The way I like to kick off these podcasts is knowing how you got involved with performing arts.
So I started as an actor primarily. I used to love performing as a child, as most of us do in the theater. You know, acting is our kind of gateway drug.
Right. Yes, yes.
Into the arts. but I discovered kind of early that I also liked to conceive and to kind of be involved with the machinations of theater as well. Like not only be inside of it, but I also liked to be outside and kind of conceive and kind of like put the thing together and be responsible for all the different parts.
Yeah.
I love to juggle things kind of conceptually and practically and logistically. And so that kind of led me to directing. As I was performing, I thought, you know what? Like, I couldn't take my eye off of like the whole picture. Mm-hmm. And I think when you're acting, you have to be kind of tunnel visioned, stay in your lane more or less in terms of like what your character is and not worry too much about what's outside. And I just could not shut off the part of my brain that was like, but why is this moment happening and what's happening over on that side?
Right.
So I was like, yeah, I'm a director.
You are a director through and through. And so you grew up in Nairobi.
Yep.
But it was a trip to London where you saw a production of Grease.
Yes.
Were you familiar enough with theater to know like, oh, this intrigues me because I'm interested in the vision of putting this together as a director?
I was intrigued by the spectacle and size of something that was like an event that was happening right in front of my eyes that kind of swept me away.
Mm.
So growing up in Kenya, most of the theater that we saw was like skits in school and like traditional dances. Nothing really that involved like a narrative, a story, and like that kind of swept you away. So I was really fortunate because my dad was an airline pilot, and we would go travel with him from time to time during the school holidays. So seeing this thing for Greece, and I didn't know what Greece was. I knew an actor who was in it from like this television show that we used to see in Kenya called Neighbors. So I was actually going to see that person in the show. I was like, oh, he's in it. I want to go see it. And then the thing just kind of swept me away. I couldn't, I think when I think about it, I just think of like colors and energy and movement and like heart and soul. And I my impulse was just to recreate that. I was like, I got to go back home and make that thing happen again. So it and I didn't know what directing was. I just knew that someone needed to be in charge of putting the thing together, and I just needed to do whatever it took to put it together.
I love that. So you like self-produced. How old were you?
15.
At 15, self-producing at 15, like obsessed. And so then when did you realize that performing arts could be a full-time gig, full-time job?
It was really coming to this country, because in Kenya, everyone who works in the theater does it semi-professionally. So you work, you have like a day job during the day, and everything that's involved in the theater, whether it's rehearsal or design meetings or performances, everything is in the evening. So you kind of hold down a job. No one does it professionally full-time. So coming to the States and falling in love with this country and with the art practice here and just learning much more than I knew being an artist in Kenya, I was like, oh, I could actually do this for real, like spend my life doing this. And I was like, this is what I want to do.
How was that initial experience? Did you immigrate to New York?
I came to Boston first. I went to Northeastern University in Boston. I was a computer science major, and then I took theater as a minor, but I didn't tell my parents because
you're like, gotta keep it under the radar.
Because you know, it's like third world, like parents, they spend a lot of money to bring you here, and like the arts are frivolous, the arts are secondary, no one makes money from it, so you just don't have a lifestyle with it. So I didn't tell my parents, and I told them like right before graduation, and they were very upset. So because I'd switched my major and I took computer science as a minor, I was like, you know what, I'm gonna, you know, just as a backup.
Had the credits.
But then by the time I got to grad school, I was like, no, I want to be doing this full time. So then I went to Columbia and I did directing there.
Do you remember the first piece of theater after immigrating here that really spoke to you?
Yes, I saw a production of Mother Courage at ART in Boston. And it was like, it was just something about it. I'd never seen something so abstract and experimental, but like was really kind of deeply rooted in something ancient, because it was Brechtian, but it was also like super, super like conceptual. And there were these like puppets on stage that didn't move. And like, it was, I was like, wow, like what is happening? So that production of Mother Courage, I remember the actors, I remember the director. It was Janos Sas, was the director. He was Hungarian. That was the thing that I was like, whoa, it's much more than just putting on a musical. Like theater and performance can also be something magical and transportive and something you don't have to understand, but can move you regardless. So that was the production.
And so in all of this, you know, and you're like pursuing it full time. You're like, sorry, parents, you gotta pursue it full time. When was the first time you felt like you identified as a director? You're like, I got this.
It was in undergrad. It was, I remember I asked to direct my own production, and I was not a senior yet, and it was, they didn't allow you to direct until you were a senior. And the professor made an exception, and she allowed me to direct. I wanted to do The Hairy Ape, the Gene O'Neill. And like, that was the first moment where I was like, I'm a director because I can do this. And I didn't know how to do it, but I did it. So it was that, it was that undergraduate production of The Hairy Ape.
I love that. That's, and I mean, what a, like, you know, what an affirmation of your excitement and skills by this professor to let you direct something in a crowd like that.
It really was. It really was.
So then, as you know, you got this career, you're thriving. What, when you're approaching work now, or when you get sent a script, what is the first couple questions, I guess, that come to your mind when reading a new script?
In a script, there has to be something that I feel like I haven't seen on stage before. I love new work. I'm all about new work, you know, like, and because there's something about the inherent challenge of bringing something to life that I haven't seen before and hasn't quite landed on the stage yet. So it has to be doing something that I feel like I haven't seen, has to be challenging me personally to do something that I haven't done in my past, and usually has to be asking to do something that feels impossible on the page. If okay. there's a challenge, if there's something that feels impossible, I'm in.
Yeah.
You know, that's what gets me. And it has to feel like it's a challenge that is rooted in something that is political or social or intellectual, that it isn't just like do XYZ for no reason. If it's like do XYZ because it's deeply, like the tree, for example, in Sugar in Our Wounds. Donye calls for a tree that sings and speaks and moves and calls out the names of the ancestors. I've never seen that before on stage. And I was like, okay, I don't know how to do this because it's never been done, but like, let's get into it and figure it out.
Right.
That's what grabs me. Yeah. That's what grabs me. Yeah.
And with that show too, when I was doing my research before the interview, I saw, you know, there was an article, it might have been with Olivia, about how that both of you, you know, when you were approaching the script, you were like, I hadn't even thought of queer people existing during this time. Like, what an interesting story to tell.
Yes.
And I think Donye is such a good example of, like, the personal is political, right? Like, I don't feel like he doesn't set out to write political work.
No, he doesn't.
It's just inherent.
From an inherently personal place.
Yeah.
How he moves through the world, how he sees the world, what he wants more of in the world. Mm-hmm. In terms of imagination, in terms of emotion, those are the things that he reaches for. They're so personal.
Yeah. So I want to hear about you guys working on, I guess, all three of those plays from his trilogy together. How has that professional relationship been for you guys?
It's been fantastic. And like you said, like, not only the kind of conceptual design elements like the tree, but like imagining ourselves existing during slavery, it did not cross my mind.
No, same,
you know,
same, honestly.
And so it felt so revolutionary, but so matter of fact at the exact same moment. Because I was like, why have I never imagined myself like existing in that time? Why have I subscribed to this notion that we just existed from, like, you know, 50, 60 years ago? Like, we've been there from the beginning of time.
Totally.
And so to be able to present that on stage, to have the distance between historical fact and emotional imagination, because we don't have so many facts about it. Mm-hmm. So the fact that Donye was audacious enough to like imagine it and present it, even though we don't have that much evidence to it, that drew me too.
Yeah.
So the work on the trilogy, that's been like some of the most fulfilling work that I've done, because he's not only a wonderful human, but just how he sees the world and how he brings his personal view into the work is really, really moving. And the trilogy, you know, they're all different. They all contain Black queerness, but they're expressed in different ways, embodied in different ways, and that's really special.
Yeah. And then in terms of setting up the rehearsal room, how, especially since you like to work on new work, you, I would imagine, always have the playwright present with you in the rehearsal
room. Yes, yes.
So what is it in terms of the dynamics of the playwright and the director? And maybe I'm naive in not knowing this, but just like how does the relationship evolve when you're in the rehearsal room versus beforehand?
Yeah, so I'm such a collaborative creature. Everything that I do stems with an interaction with someone else. Yes, I can imagine things in my own head, but at every level of the process, I like to engage with another person. So be that the playwright or the designers or the dramaturg or the producer. And so with new work, it starts with a conversation with the playwright. That's the first collaboration.
Yeah.
And then once we understand things kind of thematically, then the collaboration with the designers takes over. And then we start to imagine it, because for me, like, I'm not a designer, so I'm not trying to design it on my own, you know,
right.
I'm leaning on my impulses and on my intuition, and I'm relying on that collaboration with the designer to take that intuition and to the next level.
Yeah.
So then by the time we have like a physical landscape to support the emotional landscape of the play in terms of the design, the playwright coming back into the room with the actors that we've chosen kind of helps continue to steer us alongside what they were imagining in their head.
Yeah.
Everyone's adjusting at a certain point. You know, the playwright has something in mind. With the collaboration with the director, they're adjusting.
Mm-hmm.
With the designers, I'm adjusting. Mm-hmm. And then with actors in the room, we're all adjusting.
Right.
So at every level, we're like using each other's spirits, each other's hearts, each other's talents to continue to build upon this thing that was just a little germ at a certain point.
Right.
So the evolution of that collaboration from like the moment that the playwright conceived the thing in his brain to the moment we have the first audience, I just love like being part of that process in every single part of its incarnation.
And I'm curious too, like, in terms of all of the projects you've worked on, like when there's moments of conflict, like you guys are all mining for the truthful story, you know, but like if you guys see the truth of the show in different ways, like how does that work?
It's part of the challenge of collaboration. And to me, it's like a relationship. When you're in a relationship with someone, you can't always win, you know? You can't always have it all. Yeah. And sometimes you're right and sometimes you're not right. And even sometimes if you really think that you're right, you have to concede. You have to give. But you can't give everything. Mm-hmm. And you can't give all the time. And not everything is up for negotiation and not everything is up for discussion, you know?
Yeah.
So part of it is navigating, like, what do I really firmly believe in? And what can I concede for this moment?
Compromise.
Because I have to trust that this person also knows something that I may not know.
Yeah.
And so that thing also evolves and shifts and morphs as the process goes on.
Right.
And it manifests itself in every way. It may be about like a line in the play. It may be about casting. Mm-hmm. We may have different ideas about who to cast a certain role. It may be about design elements.
Right.
And so it is this organic breathing organism in terms of the collaboration that at every point you have to reconsider, like, how much do I really believe this thing and how much can I let this thing go?
Right.
Because sometimes when you let something go, guess what? Like, there's another idea there that you couldn't even have conceived of that was better than the one you thought of, you know?
It's like pushing for that I keep going back to ultimate truth, but like pushing and tearing back the layers, so to speak.
Yeah. And trusting. You have to trust.
Yeah.
You have to trust.
It is like a...
In
like
the thing, in each other. Yeah.
Yeah. Man, y'all, this is wild. and you brought up two at one point when you're talking about collaborative efforts that the audience kind of comes into play. And I think something that I find fascinating and interesting and I scratch my head at is like the... is that Donyer's work has been at the Atlantic and MTC, and like obviously just in general, like theater can be a very white space.
Yes.
So when you guys are in the collaborative process before bringing in the audience, are you guys thinking about that white people might be consuming
180%.
Okay.
Not only consuming, but also the theaters themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which do tend to be predominantly white. Mm-hmm. So it is about considering all of those things. And one of the other things I love so much about Donyer is he is so real. You know, he brings himself into the room in terms of who he is and every facet of that.
Mm-hmm.
So he makes it very clear from jump that if a theater agrees to do one of his plays, that there's a certain audience that he wants to be in the seats.
I see.
There are certain things that are important to him in terms of the casting and what the cast looks like. You know, colorism feeds into Sugar in Our Wounds. And part of our casting conversation was, this character is dark skin. This character is light skin.
Totally.
This character is not. You know,
totally.
And you know, you would think sometimes that that is obvious, but it's not, because like also these, a lot of the theaters are having these conversations in ways that they've never have before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're opening their doors to these stories. And along with that, there's a learning curve for them, you know?
Right.
So we do take that into consideration and ask for certain audience to be invited into the space, because
That's
these
great.
Spaces don't always feel welcoming.
Totally.
You know?
Totally.
Which is why I love the proliferation of Black Theater Night. You know, being a real thing right now in the off-Broadway community, you know, and I think it's like a stepping stone. I'm glad that it's there right now, and I'm hoping that we'll move to a point where we don't need it anymore, because almost every night will be Black Theater Night.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Totally.
But it's necessary right now, because you got to do the work.
Exactly.
And I find that these theaters are ready. They're stepping forward. They're not only programming the plays, but they're also thinking about who's in the audience and what their responsibility is in terms of that as well.
Absolutely. So right now you are working on Passage by Chris Chen at Soho Rep. Talk to me about how you got involved with the project.
So I read Passage 2 years ago. It was sent to me by Long Wharf. They were programming it for their reading series. And I just absolutely fell in love with the play because I knew Chris Chen. I had seen his play Caught that the play company did. And so I read it, and it was... It's a really, really strange read, because if you imagine reading a script and there are no names, there are letters instead of the names. So you start to realize every assumption that you put onto even someone's name.
Oh, interesting.
That it helps kind of guide you through following a story.
Yeah.
Like if you have a character named Barbara or you have a character named Sean, like even that, you have an impression of what a Barbara and what a Sean and what a Tom is in your head, right?
Totally.
So when you take that away and you put these characters in two different countries and you're trying to keep up who's in which country, it's a real challenge. So I read this play and I was like, oh my God, this is really challenging, but like there's something really, really interesting about this world that is creating, and like I want to get like in you know, in the ring with it. And so we did a reading at Long Wharf, and it was really fantastic. And we, so do you know what the play is about?
I know that they're about two people living in two different countries that are trying to create a mutual relationship.
Yes. So it's, and because it's, so it's this kind of like a riff on this novel called A Passage to India by E.M. Forster that takes place in colonial India and centers on a relationship between a white Brit and a Indian woman. And you kind of follow their the path of their relationship. Set against this backdrop of colonialism,
right.
Understanding that, you know, one entity is in power and here has usurped power and the other entity is not. So you kind of see this dynamics play out in what you understand. I mean, you got white people and you got brown people. You know who's in power and who isn't.
Right.
So you get to bring all those assumptions with you when you experience the story, and it kind of and you get to see how this relationship manifests itself. So what Chris does is to strip away all the identifiers that we know from that original story. So instead of Britain and India, it's country X and country Y. And instead of all the names of the characters, which would tell you who's Indian and who's British, they're letters. So you have characters called X, G, D, B.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, so he strips away all the identifiers of race, nationality, even gender, so that you end up with these two groups with a disparity of power, and you get to see how power plays out between two groups without what we understand to be the signifiers of power.
Right, and without our own biases or predilections or whatever.
Without all those things that we bring to the table, you know? And it's a real exercise. Because then what do the actors look like? What does your cast look like?
So yeah, what did you guys decide? Like, okay.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting journey. So when we were at Long Wharf, because I always knew that I wasn't interested in a story that placed something recognizable on X and Y. So I wasn't going to do a production where X were white and Y were people of color, you know, or vice versa, because I didn't want to play into the dynamics that we understand in this world. White people are usually the ones who colonize brown countries. And I didn't want to subvert that in some way so that like the people of color were the ones colonizing white people, because I'm not interested in seeing that science fiction. And so when we did the production at Long Wharf, we actually had a cast that was open. We cast everyone. So we're like, it's going to be open. We're going to have white people, brown people, black people. It's and in terms of nationalities, they'll be Indian, they'll be Latinx, they'll be Caucasian. And so we were kind of, not universal. What's the word I'm looking at? We were.
Universal works.
Yeah. We were being universal about it. We were trying to like be all encompassing and say that this is everyone, you know? So there's not, you can't apply any specific thing. But what I found in that production was that once you put whiteness on stage with people of color, then that's a comment, because then you have to choose which role is going to be white and which one isn't, because you cannot be random about that stuff. The play is so specific about the dynamics of power. And so I actually found from the Long Wharf experience that there should be no white people on stage in this play. So it's all people of color in the cast. And it's not only people of color specifically, it's also what we were finding was people of color who, ideally, because of not wanting to place it in a specific era or a specific country, the preference was for people of color who weren't easily placeable in terms of what their racial background might be. So are they mixed race? Could they be Latinx or Middle Eastern? You know, like that ambiguity was also interesting. So we started from that point in terms of our casting. And we actually have a cast that's all people of color. And there is a kind of like ambiguity about them as a collective, you know? Because I really did want to do what Chris was doing, which was remove signifiers. And we live in a world where we understand signifiers. So even if it were like about colorism, even if it was one country were dark skin and one were light skin, we understand that story too. You know? So I wanted to really, really lean into like taking away the signifiers. So our cast is all people of color. And I would say folks who live on the spectrum of being identifiable on either side of the like the racial divide.
That's so y'all are getting a masterclass in directing right now. I hope you realize that I am. I'm like fiercely taking all these mental notes, gonna journal later. And so, I mean, with that, like, what if you could distill it down to a few things of what you want audiences to take away when they see Passage, could you? Is that not a fair question?
Totally, no. I want audiences to think about power and how it's not only explicit, but sometimes how implicit it is in ourselves. Like, look, we all have privilege. Some people have more than others, some people have different kinds of privilege, mm-hmm. you know? And I think the play just asks us to continue to consider what ways that we are subscribing to these power hierarchies that exist in our societies that we may not be aware of, you know? So I hope the play makes you consider that. It is very contemplative. It is a play that allows you to reflect. So I hope it allows people to reflect on their own lives in very specific ways. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you go to the theater to be immersed in another world. Yeah. I hope people come to this play to be reflective about their own world, about their own place in the world, you know? And I hope also that the world that we've crafted is very open and very theatrical, in a sense of the shifts that occur rely on the imagination more than they do on any fancy kind of scene changes, you know? Okay. Because I felt like in reading the script, you know, Chris was stripping away all the signifiers of identity. I also wanted to strip away everything that didn't feel essential to telling the story on stage.
Yeah.
So we started with a blank canvas.
Okay.
What do we need? What do we absolutely need? What can we not do without?
Right.
So we, in terms of what the actors have to work with, we have only the bare minimum of what they need to tell the story.
Interesting.
You know?
So
I hope again, like the power of the theater and of the imagination to be able to be swept away and to journey with these characters is something also that, you know, people will feel when they experience the story.
Absolutely. And if y'all want to get tickets, you go to sohorep.org/passage. Well, and so you have such a, I guess, diverse body of work in terms of directing shows, even if they have the same, you know, through line theme of challenging you, it's something you haven't seen on stage. But is there something director wise that you haven't done yet that you would love to do?
Musical. A big musical. Look,
producers.
Like I told you, Grease was my entry, you know, and there's a musical out there that I'm workshopping a musical that I conceived called Goddess at New York Stage and Film summer with Jocelyn Bio and Michael Thurber.
Shout out.
Yeah, yeah. This has been a project that has been gestating for me actually since I was in high school in Kenya. I've been dreaming up the story. And so, yeah, taking that to the next level is something that I'm really ready to do because I love the story and I love musicals too.
Yes.
So, but it also has to do that thing that I said. Like I really do want it to be challenging and also feel like it's breaking some new...
Right.
Not breaking a barrier, but like I wanted to do something that I feel like I haven't seen on stage.
Totally.
In terms of musical.
And I feel like, I mean, I love musicals, so this is no shade to musicals, but I feel like people often think of just big spectacle, no substance.
Uh-huh.
But they totally can have substance. They can make you feel, they can make you think. And I feel like
absolutely
any musical you touch will make people do that.
Oh,
so I'm so excited.
Thank you. Thank
yes.
You.
So the way I like to wrap up the podcasts are with two questions as follows. If you could recommend a piece of black art, whether that's a piece of theater or a film or a musical album or a book, what would it be?
Well, speaking of musicals then, I would say Strange Loop by Michael R. Jackson.
Yes, podcast alum.
Incredible musical. You have to go see it.
I'm excited for that too. So I plus one that recommendation.
Right.
And then if you could give a shout out to a black artist, someone you've worked with or someone who's just killing the game right now, who would it be?
Okay. I recommend Philip Howes. He's an extraordinary writer. He had a piece called Frontiers Sounds Frontiers of the Bushwick Star a couple of years ago. And he has a piece called Self-Portraits that he's written. It's very it's very autobiographical. And it's at Brick, I believe. Brick in Brooklyn.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're busy with Passion.
No, please. Thank you.
To talk with us today. And if people want to follow your journey on social media, where can they follow you?
Facebook. Yeah.
My website?
SahimAli.com.
Perfect. Easy breezy, you guys. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Felicia.
Until next time, y'all.